Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation on this Aloha Friday, April 24th. It's been a little more than 24 hours since Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke announced she would be taking a leave of absence after receiving a target letter in a state bribery probe. We hear from a former state attorney general and former lieutenant governor who 8 years ago found himself seat-warming in the number two top job in the state. And we talk about insurance. We were worried about rising rates following the wildfires, and now after the floods, what's around the corner? Farmers affected by the recent floods are eligible for 3 months of free soil testing thanks to the reopening of a soil testing lab. And thousands are expected to flock to this weekend's Sustainability Expo here in Honolulu. We learn about issues around solar and wind energy. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii has a new acting lieutenant governor this morning. Sylvia Luke stepped down after receiving a target letter in a bribery investigation yesterday. The state comptroller, Keith Regan, who was sixth in line in succession, according to law, now is seat warming until the election later this year. This morning, we have former State Attorney General Doug Chin joining us. He found himself tapped to be Lieutenant Governor when Shan Tsutsui stepped down for personal reasons back in 2018. Chin is in studio live with us today. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
Yeah, I don't know what it was like when you heard the news, but we were...
It does feel like history is repeating itself.
Yeah, but yeah. Going through that whole succession list. So talk about that.
Sure. Basically, it all goes back to the law. Like, in other words, I think of it like this: the Hawaii Revised Statutes for all the lawyers out there. They know that there's about 700 chapters. This is chapter 26, which I don't mean to say in some sort of cute way that the law works chronologically, but it tells you how early this was set in the books in Hawaii. And it's this chapter talks about what happens if the governor is ever temporarily unavailable or temporarily disabled from being able to carry out or perform their duties. And then there's also a section that talks about what happens if the lieutenant governor is temporarily unavailable or temporarily unable to carry out their duties. And when that happens, then the law says that the position of the lieutenant governor shall devolve. Which is a verb I never heard before, by the way. I don't even think devolve. I've never even seen it anywhere else in the law except for these sections. It says it will devolve upon, and then it goes through a line of succession, and it goes to the Senate president, and then it goes to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, then the Attorney General, and then it starts going through a bunch of cabinet directors. But it goes through about a dozen or so people. And I know a lot of times people look at that law these days, we're in the 2020s, realize that was written back in the 1950s or 60s. And that was, we now live in a time when we have video conferencing, we have, Starlink, we don't have, there is no problems at all being able to communicate, even though you're off island. And yet this law still exists. That whenever the governor leaves the island, the lieutenant governor leaves, mm-hmm. then there has to be some sort of succession. And the best I can figure it out is I think it really ends up mattering when you have a major emergency. Like in other words, if there was a tsunami or a very bad earthquake or a massive power outage or an act of war or something like that.
Wildfire.
Wildfire. You need somebody on the island who
right.
is
Boots
the head
the
of
ground.
State. And that's the thinking behind having a governor there. So it's in those extreme situations, you have to have somebody who's here. And then secondly, you also have to have a lieutenant governor, a backup quarterback, if the governor is ever not available. And so I think that's the thinking behind why the succession takes place.
Well, when I was going through, who's next, and then Seth Colby, you know, who budget and finance, and I was thinking, gosh, he just barely got named to that position. Sure. And I didn't realize until reading the paper this morning that he hadn't been confirmed. And right. So they would skip him, and so it would go down to the director of the Department of Accounting and General Services, our comptroller.
Yeah, and that's where he landed on Keith Reagan, who I knew from when he was the managing director of the County of Maui, and I was in the County of Honolulu, and he's great.
And capable hands.
I wish him well. Absolutely. And I think one of the good things for people to know is that whenever these types of successions happen, I think, like, everybody who's not in the state should just know that the state is well run. That there are some great meaning that there's great workers that are there all the time that know the infrastructure, know what needs to be done, and they're there to support whoever is taking whoever's walking into that position.
Right. Well, you know, what were your thoughts as this? You know, you're probably flashing back when you heard the news about what it was like when you were asked to take the job as lieutenant governor back then.
Sure. So it was surprising. I didn't know Lieutenant Governor Sisui well at all, but when he made the decision to step down early, it didn't even occur to me that we were going to get to me. like in other words, you have there's some other positions that are in between. But I think what I didn't bank on is that for many people, and I think even myself as well, it's hard to just walk away from the job that you have at the time and even the staff that you have underneath you and then go into a completely new office. And so I can understand why for so many times when the opportunity gets offered to, for example, Senate President or the Speaker of the House, they'll turn it down because they are in the middle of the legislative
session. Critical time.
They need to do other things and they realize that will create other dominoes that have to be figured out. I think for me, when I heard that the Senate President didn't take it and didn't accept the position, and then same thing for the Speaker of the House. It's funny. Before this, you were actually asking me who asked me, and I don't remember. I feel like
it's a blur.
It was like a phone call that came into the office where somebody was like, "Okay, it now is devolving." Again, that word which I hadn't heard before. It's devolving upon the Attorney General. Are you going to take it?
Right.
I did. For a couple of reasons. First, it was the right thing to do. I just felt like, you know, we could run through the whole cabinet and nobody else, you know, we're going to run into a situation where we start running out of people. So I ended up taking it. I'll be honest though with you, Kat, I think the other thing that was going on for me at the time was that I was in the middle of my first and only run for political office. I was trying for Congress. And at the time, there was this criticism that was like circulating around that as an appointed attorney general, I shouldn't be running for office at the same time. And so there were actually calls that for me to resign. Quite honestly, there was a pragmatic decision-making going on in my mind as well, where I was, I decided it'd be better for me to step away from being attorney general and just go into this position where no one would complain about me running for office, and to remove the distraction that would come from me continuing to serve as attorney general, having to answer questions about that. That's how it worked itself out. And so for 10 months, I was over there in the lieutenant governor's office.
And Keith will probably find himself, you know, in that same quandary, like okay, I've got to pivot. All these construction projects that I was, you know, up on top of, now he's got to, I believe, focus on broadband and the preschool initiative. Right. So it's a total mindset.
And you know what's possible is I think he might be doing both, if I'm understanding what's happening. He's taking both roles, which I know he can do. But I think it's just, that's going to be a lot of responsibilities.
Chuckle because I put in a request to talk to Keith Reagan before we knew he was going to take this slot. So I was thinking, I might not get a call.
Might be a little busy right now.
Yes. You know, we're in a strange time, and this notion of getting a target letter, unusual.
Sure. Not unusual in federal law enforcement. So getting a target letter is, I don't want to say it's what always happens, but it is definitely a construct of the federal law enforcement system, where before they even bring charges and indict somebody, there's an initial target letter which is written to the individual saying, here are the potential charges that you might be facing. There's substantial evidence that could be brought against you. There's often an invitation to meet with law enforcement to try to explain their position. It puts the individual who is receiving the target letter on notice that this is happening, so that they can, in fairness, present a defense or mm-hmm. find a lawyer, put together a legal team if they need to do something like that. I have to say this. I've never seen it happen at the state or county level. That doesn't mean that state prosecutors like the attorney general or county prosecutors can't do something like that. It's just not part of the state and local system, if you will. There's no requirement.
So it's highly unusual.
It is unusual. Not wrong to do it, but it is unusual.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how that plays out. But certainly the turn of events of day to day this week, bombshell,
right.
You know, and yeah. Then we're just watching the ripples.
Yeah. We should add that obviously the people who have received the target letter, they are presumed innocent until they're proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Getting a target letter doesn't even necessarily mean that the lieutenant governor is going to be charged with anything. It really is just one step further there, but we'll have to see what happens. This is a story that continues to be developing.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Doug. We really appreciate you sharing that. We have been hearing from Doug Chin, former lieutenant governor and former state attorney general for Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from Legacy of Life Hawaii, dedicated to saving and enhancing lives through organ and tissue recovery, recognizing April as National Donate Life Month. Organ donor registration at registerme.org.
This week in This American Life, woman goes into a casino, plays blackjack, loses a ton of money, and then sues the casino. Which, of course, raises a question.
What? Why is she not liable? It seems like if you go to a casino, that's like, you know what you're doing.
Because at the time of those losses, she has...
Stories about blackjack this week.
She has no control.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from NAREIT Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NAREITHawaii.com.
Today we hear from the State Insurance Commissioner, Scott Seike. The former House Speaker was a strong voice when a condo insurance crisis began emerging in his district of Kaka'ako. Underinsured high-rises were among the first signs that something was wrong. The insurance industry was beginning to show the strain of natural disasters across the country, including the Maui wildfires. And the recent storms have only added to the woes. It put the spotlight on the federal government's National Flood Insurance Program, sometimes referred to as NFIP. Here's Psyche.
People need to be aware and prepared. What the Kona storm showed us is that there is yet another layer of risk in Hawaii, which is flooding. And people just need to be aware of what that entails and how to be prepared for that in the future.
Well, you know, I know that the new flood maps are coming out, you know, this summer, and that's going to make people, you know, think twice about the cost of insuring properties to make sure you can rebuild. Coming off of the latest, you know, storms, what are you hearing from out in the field?
So our office participated at the recovery centers that were organized on the North Shore over the past month, and we were able to assist 125 households that came to our table with specific insurance-related questions. And unfortunately, a number of those people did not have flood insurance, so we weren't able to provide some direct help for them. Fortunately, on the other hand, there were a number that did have flood insurance, so we were able to refer them to the appropriate agencies. But again, it just goes to the point that people need to be aware of the of flood risk and the need for flood insurance.
And, you know, we did talk to the Small Business Administration, you know, this weekend, and I know that lots of these low-interest loans and help for the impacts of this economic disaster are available now. But what else should people need to know if they have been affected? You know, where else can they go for help?
Sure. So there's now assistance through FEMA and the SBA, as you mentioned. But as far as on the insurance side, if people haven't done so yet, they should contact their flood insurer. In most cases, it would be an NFIP policy. People should also contact their homeowner insurer in case there's some kind of coverage through their homeowner's policy. And for those who had any kind of auto damage, they should contact their auto insurer because there might be a possibility of coverage for damaged vehicles. There are still different options available.
But this whole notion of being underinsured or not having the flood insurance, so then what challenges does that present if you're trying to rebuild?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big challenge. Currently, the NFIP is probably the largest flood insurer in Hawaii, and they have a coverage limit of $250,000. And it kind of goes to the whole issue of the risk of flooding and the cost of flood damage. Flood insurance has been an area that's been hard to insure, and that's why the federal government created the NFIP program, you know, about 50 years ago, which is to provide policies for homeowners. So I know that there is a limit on the NFIP policy. I think that's why people will have to look for alternative sources of insurance that, you know, that I just mentioned.
And then what else are you hearing on the condo front? Because I know, you know, you had, you know, raised the flag about what you were seeing in your district when you were a lawmaker in the Kaka'ako area.
Sure. So, you know, about three or four years ago, there was somewhat of a crisis with condo associations obtaining hurricane insurance coverage for their buildings. And the premiums were increasing exponentially. So the legislature and the governor worked to reinstate the Hawaii Hurricane Relief Fund. And the HHRF became operational on June 24, about 10 months ago. And so it's actually been very positive because the HHRF is now selling hurricane policies to eligible condo associations. So far, HHRF has sold 104 policies to condos, and those condos are seeing average savings of about $50,000 through those policies. There's also been an indirect impact, though, because what's happening is condos are not only getting quotes from HHRF, but they're also getting quotes from their private insurers. The private insurers are matching the HHRF rates. So in a lot of cases, the condos just return to their private insurer and get their hurricane coverage through them at a reduced rate. So there's savings going on all around at the condo association level, which is really good news because, as I mentioned earlier, the rates were just drastically increasing a few years ago.
So it's eased that pressure. But, you know, now with, you know, this crazy back-to-back storms and the single-family homeowners that we're seeing that were impacted, I mean, that was just so unexpected.
Right. So whenever there's a disaster, whether it's in Hawaii or in another state or in another country, I think the insurance industry watches to see what the reaction will be when it comes to insurance rates and how these disasters will impact the cost of insurance. Because, you know, insurance rates, unfortunately, are affected by these kinds of disaster incidents. So we'll see. And that's one reason why we're monitoring rates in Hawaii to see what the reaction is to the Lahaina wildfire and whether or not, you know, to what extent rates will be increasing as a result of the wildfire here.
And then, you know, this week there was a report that was issued
by the insurance project. What are your thoughts on their findings?
Yeah, it was the report was issued by an organization that I had never heard of before until the press release was issued. You know, I think on the positive side, the report does highlight the interrelationship between the environment, you know, climate change, how it impacts risk, and then how it impacts the cost of insurance. So that's the positive aspect of the report. But on the downside, the report does, it inflates numbers, it inflates data, or so-called data, to reach conclusions that I'm not sure are substantiated. So in that sense, it might create some public confusion or anxiety. This organization also, by the way, when you look at their website, there's no contact information. Like, I'm not sure who organized it. I'm not sure who funds it, who staffs it. I'm not sure where it's located. So it's like an anonymous organization out there, you know, in social media.
Interesting. Yeah, because I wasn't familiar with it and just curious to see, you know, what they would come up with. But is there anything else that you think we should be looking or tracking closely, especially with the new flood maps that are coming out this summer?
Yeah, so people should be aware. So for flood maps, Oahu will begin using new revised flood maps on June 10. Currently, there are about 15,000 parcels that are in high-risk flood zones. If you're in a high-risk flood zone and if you have a federally backed mortgage, then you are required to have flood insurance. So currently there's 15,000 parcels in that category, but with the new flood map, there will be an additional almost 4,000 more parcels that are going to be in this high-risk flood zone. So people need to be aware of whether or not they are going to be impacted by the flood zone maps. If they have a mortgage, then their lender or their bank, the mortgage company, is probably going to send them a letter informing them that they need to obtain flood insurance if they haven't already done so. So people just need to be aware of that. They can go to the city website. It's called resilientoahu.org to view the new flood maps to see if their home will be impacted.
Right. So, you know, the whole thing is we've got a budget for that added cost, and June is not far away.
Yeah, and you know, as far as flood insurance, as I mentioned earlier, NFIP is pretty much the dominant insurance carrier. There are private alternatives as well, so they really should shop around. NFIP has limits on the coverage amount. They may be able to obtain higher coverage limits through private insurance, but it'll probably be more expensive.
We have been hearing from State Insurance Commissioner Scott Seike, who is closely monitoring the changing insurance landscape.
Tune in to HPR2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra presents Beethoven Fest, the first in a series of concerts devoted to the works of Ludwig von Beethoven. In this matinee performance, we'll hear Symphony No. 1 and Symphony No. 3, Eroica. We'll also hear the world premiere of Ye Xiao Gong's original work, also called Eroica. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
There is now additional help for farmers across the state who were affected by the back-to-back Kona low storms. The College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resilience at the University of Hawaii this week reopened a shutter testing center for soil and plants to help farmers get back on their feet. Issues with fungus and bacteria are among the concerns. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Dean Parwinder Grewal. He made the reopening of the testing center a high priority and spoke about the farmers' ongoing concerns.
Farmers would be definitely concerned about do they have enough nutrients in the soil, because the floods water might take the nutrients, soil could be washed away. The second concern the farmers would have is whether there are pathogens, bacteria, fungi in the soil that might have come from other farms or from urban areas and whatnot. That would be their second concern. They're also concerned about pesticide contamination, because some of the farms might think that, you know, other farmers might be using some pesticides, or in urban areas, the pesticides are used as well for lawn care, tree care, and whatnot. So they would be worried about that. And some are worried about heavy metals, heavy metal contamination. The testing that we will provide that does not include pesticide contamination analysis or heavy metal analysis. However, today, Department of Health announced that there is very limited or no contamination of pesticide or heavy metals in the samples that they have tested so far, or the areas, flooded areas that they have tested.
So heavy metals and pesticides might be handled by Department of Health, whereas the Agricultural Diagnostic Service Center will handle plant disease identification, fungal pathogens, soil nutrients. What else will you be testing for?
Correct. We will also test plant tissue for nutrient analysis. We would also provide insect identification, you know, any pest problems that they might be anticipating or have already on the plants that are growing.
Can you just give a couple of examples of some of these diseases, some of these fungi or pathogens that could be increasing in prevalence after the flooding?
Yeah, I don't see many insects increasing in, because right now there aren't that much planted, but the pathogens are likely. Mostly, you know, bacterial pathogens that could be rotting, that because of high humidity, water, fungal pathogens of all kinds of crops, vegetable crops specifically, and some fruit crops as well. So mostly bacterial and fungal pathogens, a whole diversity of them, depending upon the type of crop that they grow. It will depend on what they are growing and what kind of pathogen might surge, because the condition of high moisture, high humidity would increase their population. Quite often these pathogens are present in the soil, but their numbers are not enough to cause a major damage.
I see. So it's the kind of thing where the flooding would have provided the conditions for these pathogens to flourish, to increase in number, but they're always there at low right. levels. It's just now that they might be causing issues to a farmer's crop.
Right. Exactly.
Talk about the steps that farmers can take to take advantage of this free testing.
Yeah, so farmers would need to collect the samples. We are providing instructions how to collect the soil samples and plant samples. They can send the samples directly, drop it off at our own facility. But to make it easier for the flood-affected farmers, we have identified some specific sites close to the flooded areas. So they can then drop off their samples there. And our staff, our extension staff, our other staff will be picking up those samples and bringing it to our lab for analysis. The farmers do need to fill a form to tell us where their farm is located, what kind of analysis they're looking for, and what their concern is. We would also want them to drop off the samples on Mondays so that we have enough time to process the samples before they deteriorate. So that's another piece that the farmers need to be concerned about. Yeah, our goal is a turnaround within 2 weeks. That is what we are aiming for. And depends on if we got way too many samples, then it might take a little longer. But our goal is to you know, turn around our sample analysis quickly?
I imagine it depends on what you identify in there, but how fixable are some of these problems? You know, how useful is it to a farmer if you identify a particular pathogen? What steps can they then take?
So two things. In terms of the soil analysis, we would provide a recommendation as to that what nutrient deficiencies they have in the soil or in the plant tissue, how they can correct it, what kind of product they need to apply, and how much they need to apply. So that is a correctable problem. In terms of the disease, if we find a disease, that we would also give them, share a fact sheet with them, make a recommendation that you have this particular disease, this is the fungicide to use, or this is how you can reduce the spread of the disease to other plants in their farm. We will provide specific recommendation for both of those aspects. And also on the insect side, if they find some kind of, you know, leafhopper or some pest is identified to be present, what kind of insecticide they need to spray. We will provide examples of recommended pesticides. Some could be organic pesticides, some could be others, depending upon what they are producing and whether their farm is organic certified or not.
And is this program specific to Oahu farmers, or can farmers across the state take advantage of testing?
Farmers that are affected by the floods throughout Hawaii can take advantage of this. We know that Oahu was more affected, right? The flood, the repeated flooding has affected Oahu farmers more so than other places. But as you can see that even though it wasn't widespread damage, say on Big Island, there are areas in Maui that were affected, but there could be areas that are affected. And the location of the farm also, it depends on the location. If it's a low-lying area, there were good rains, so that we are open to farmer telling us that they were affected, and we will do the analysis.
And reopening this soil service center has mattered a lot to you. This is a promise that you made early on when you became dean. So how does it feel now getting to say you did this many years in the making at a time when it seems very important for the community to have a resource like this?
Yeah, it feels actually very, very good. I'm very excited about being able to deliver on this promise, because our college is called the Land Grant College. Our mission is to help people improve their lives. And providing this kind of service, which is local, Hawaii-based, because much of our research is also Hawaii-based. We know the specific problems, different types of soils, different types of issues that occur in Hawaii. So having a local service like this is far more effective for the farmers. It's far more useful and may even save time and money to the farmers. So for me, to fulfill our mission, it was extremely important. So I worked over last 2 years with staff, faculty to maneuver it in this direction, because to undo a decision that my predecessor has taken, it also takes a lot of political maneuvering within the institution. So we are very happy that we were able to do this. And the staff worked really hard on it as well, because now we are using new methods. We have bought new equipment, new machines. We have hired new staff. So there are a lot of improvements. You know, beyond this 3 month period or the flood affected farmers, farmers will be able to submit their samples on stations throughout Hawaii, wherever we operate our stations. So they don't have to pay postage to ship samples to Oahu. That's one. Second, they can also fill the forms electronically. They don't have to be posting the forms and stuff. third, they can actually pay electronically as well, because in the past, either they were paying cash or they have to write a check.
Anything else you want listeners to know right now about the center reopening or this three-month free testing program for farmers affected by the flooding?
Yeah, it is really unfortunate that these kinds of floods have happened. At the same time, it is possible that the frequency of such floods may increase. So farmers need to make long-term plans as to how they're going to handle these. And all of us have to work together to do that. But at the same time, I would encourage all the farmers in affected areas right now to take advantage of the three-month free sample analysis that we are offering. And that way, we will also know more about the situation, the soils, because that analysis also informs our work moving forward and our research as well, because that information we use to further improve the recommendations and everything else that goes with this kind of work. So I wish them well, and hopefully they will be back in the field and restarting their operations very soon, and we look forward to helping them. Our extension workforce is highly alert, and they are working directly with farmers. They should call our extension office for any help that they need. We have assembled additional resources related to how you come out of the flood and what things that you need to care for, need to know how you can restart your operation.
That was Parwinder Grewal, Dean of UH's College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resilience, on the reopening of a soil testing center. The facility hopes to expand with heavy metals analysis and water and nutrient testing. We'll have more information on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, later today.
On the next Radiolab,
there was an infestation of an insect called
the New World Screwworm,
also known as flesh-eating worm.
Oh. I mean, these are about the worst parasite on Earth.
Honestly, nightmarish flesh-eating parasite.
I cannot imagine anything worse than these guys.
Can a species be so terrible?
Would it ever be okay to bring about the extinction of a species?
We need to wipe it out?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Does your significant other make you feel like you're important to them?
He just didn't text me like often enough or kind of speedily enough. And I realized later, it just, the lack of texting, that lack of responsiveness did not make me feel loved.
The distinction between being loved and feeling loved. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
You know, it's fitting that the Sustainability Expo and Electric House Show kicks off at the Blaisdell this weekend, as we have just come off Earth Day. It'll feature the latest in green products, as well as a number of workshops and talks. Author Bill McKibben will give the keynote. He has long been sounding the alarm on the climate crisis and has written more than 20 books on the subject. The expo this year is thanks to Clean Technica and its founder, Scott Cooney. McKibben and Cooney spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson about what Hawaii can learn about the latest advances in solar and wind. McKibben starts by talking about Pakistan, which is one of the world's most vulnerable nations to extreme weather.
Pakistan is fascinating. Pakistan, by the way, suffered more from climate change than any country on Earth. The temperature in the summertime routinely tops 125 degrees now in their urban areas, and they've had the two worst floods in the world in 2010 and 2023. But they have one geographic advantage, which is a border with China. And about 2 years ago, across that border, people began to import huge numbers of these cheap Chinese solar panels, which the Chinese can produce for next to nothing. This wasn't a government program. It was people fed up with expensive and unreliable electricity. they were buying panels and then just going on YouTube to figure out how to snap them together. And within 18 months, they'd built the equivalent of half the country's national electric grid, such that by last fall, Pakistan was calling up its main liquefied natural gas supplier, Qatar, and telling them, we don't need those 24 shiploads of LNG you're supposed to be sending us. We'll pay the penalty rather than take delivery because we've got enough sun. It's a remarkable story in one of the poorest places in the world. And now it's being followed by similar results in Africa, where people are putting up solar panels for electricity for the very first time. There's still 600 million people without power in Africa for whom fossil fuel might never have been discovered. And they're going to get their first power from the sun, and it's going to be cheap and useful. So this story is happening at every level. I mean, some of the most wealthy and advanced places in the world. California now produces most days more than 100% of its power from renewable energy for long stretches of the day. At night, when the sun goes down on the Golden State, it's big batteries that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon that carry the grid. Those batteries didn't exist 3 years ago. So change here has been so sudden, so startling, and so hopeful that I think the rest of us are just beginning to start catching up.
Yeah, some remarkable numbers there. And it's reminiscent, especially with the Pakistan example, of transformation to cell phones, right? Because we're talking about landscapes here that don't have really reliable grids to begin with, but are making this leap to the new technology, bypassing this thing that we've all been wrestling with for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. And if you can avoid having to build a huge centralized grid with a lot of giant centralized power plants and things, it may turn out to be a very transformative thing. Australia, which has put up a lot of solar energy, so much so that beginning in June, all Australians, whether they have solar panels or not, will get 3 free hours of electricity every afternoon, forever going forward. They're all out buying storage batteries so they can fill them up between noon and three and run their house on free electricity all night. This is what's possible if we move decisively in this direction. And you would think Hawaii would be primed for this right now after a couple of storms demonstrating what climate change is going to look like in the tropics. And after the oil price increases that come from this latest war, sunlight has to travel 93 million miles to reach the Earth, but none of those miles are through the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah. And boy, I think you just grabbed all of our listeners' attention with the notion of 3 free hours of electricity today. We wrestle with such high cost. Scott, you're someone who also knows well the potential of solar and wind energy. You've talked sustainability at UH before starting clean tech. Maybe tell us about this transformation that Bill's describing from your perspective.
Everything Bill is saying is super spot on. The technology has just advanced to a point where it's just better, it's just cheaper, and it's much easier to apply than it even was a few years ago. The energy efficiency is also a huge gain we've had in the last couple of years with heat pump, water heaters, and heat pump now air conditioning systems coming online that use dramatically less electricity. So energy efficiency is the best return on investment for everything. Topping that off with the solar and the wind just really completes the picture. So out here, you know, our rates are sky high. HECO just announced another 30% increase, you know, so the return on investment for homeowners is great for solar and batteries. The return on investment for renters on doing anything energy efficiency related is also incredibly high. So it's just a good way for us to increase affordability for Hawaii residents.
And, you know, a lot of times when we talk about this issue, I think it can be overwhelming, overwhelming on two fronts. One, just the global scale of the issue that we're facing as a species. And two, politically, right? We think about national politics, international fights. It's hard for any of us as individuals to wrap our heads around. But there's so much that can be done at a state and local level. Tell us about what you see, Bill, there in terms of possibilities and what you've seen in terms of things being done at the state and local level.
Absolutely. Look, from my point of view, Washington is beyond reach right at the moment. Hopefully we'll change some of that come November. But for now, we're working very hard at state and local levels. When I say we, I started this thing a few years ago called Third Act that organizes old people like me. And we've got 120,000 elder Americans hard at work defending democracy and climate. And one of our big pushes this year is this campaign we're calling Simplify Solar. And it aims to do two things. One is to ease the permitting burden for rooftop solar. Americans pay a lot more than Australians or Europeans for putting solar on the roof. And a big reason is we have too many unnecessary rules and regulations. Basically, in much of the world, this isn't that much harder than like getting a refrigerator or something. Here, it's much harder than it needs to be. And we can change those rules. There are these good instant permitting apps that are now in use in California and New Jersey that provide a kind of guide for how to make this much simpler. Meanwhile, we're also having a big campaign, very successful all of a sudden, around what we're calling balcony or plug-in solar. If you'd been to Europe in the last 3 years, you would have seen millions, literally millions, many millions of apartment buildings. Suddenly, people have a solar panel strapped to the railing of the balcony. The person who owns the apartment, who rents the apartment, went to IKEA or whatever you call Best Buy in Milan, you know, and came home 300 euros poorer, but with a solar panel designed to be zip tied to that railing. On the back is a plug. You plug it into the wall. That is it. No electrician required, no nothing. And it often provides, Scott will know better, but in many cases, 20-25% of the power that an apartment uses. So not everything, but not nothing either. That's illegal almost everywhere in the U.S., but we're fixing that. The first break came last year in that deep progressive bastion, the state of Utah, which passed the enabling legislation by unanimous vote of the state legislature on the argument from a Republican libertarian state senator that if this is good enough for the people of Stuttgart, it's good enough for the people of Salt Lake City. And we've been campaigning hard on this. We have bills in 28 state legislatures now. And in the last 2 weeks, Virginia and Maine have done the same thing. I think we'll have three or four more by the time I get out to Hawaii to celebrate. So this is a real revolution. It's the absolute dead simplest way to capture the power of the sun, and perfect for renters because you don't have control of the rooftop. But you know, this is when if you change apartments, you just move your solar panel right with you. So there's a revolution underway. Utilities are always a little slow to pick up on revolutionary change. Their prime and understandable interest is always stability above all. But we've got some other things to worry about right now, like affordability, like the climate crisis. And the good news is that both batteries and solar panels get better and better. They're actually enhancing stability on grids across the world now. The place that put the most renewable power up in America last year was the state of Texas. And they've said it's dramatically stabilized their grid. They have far fewer blackouts and brownouts and things than they used to because they've got all this dependable. The sun rises every day. That's a good thing.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you're highlighting these examples, Utah and Texas. It really shows that this is a divisive political issue in one sphere in this sort of the national context, but certainly not on the state and local level. And I think that's encouraging because it's so easy to find these splinters. But when you find a sensibility across the political spectrum, it's encouraging. Scott, as someone who's familiar with the landscape here in the islands, how is all this sounding to you in terms of what Bill's throwing out there in terms of opportunities for us to seize on a state and local level? And are there things you see policymakers looking at now, even in the legislative session, that could help us hasten this transformation?
Well, yeah, you know, the Lanai Solar is such a huge advantage and it really does cut across everything. It helps with affordability and for renters, it democratizes the whole situation. That's great. We'll see how that goes and hopefully we'll be one of the next states to pass that into law. I know they're working on fire safety and there's some concerns and that sort of thing, but UL certification is coming online for this stuff. It will become very standard very soon, and hopefully we'll see that passed pretty quickly. And that's the biggest thing. It can help with affordability for so many Hawaii residents who don't own their roofs.
And I know that humans, we consume more energy every year. And I wonder if talking about consumption is part of the equation. Clean energy from the sun is sustainable for the planet in a way that fossil fuels never were. But can our rate of consumption be sustained?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And more pointed all the time as data centers emerge as yet another way to consume huge amounts of energy. I think that over time, humans will figure out better ways to amuse themselves than we have and consume less. I don't think that's likely to happen at a speed necessary to deal with the climate crisis, which is the biggest ticking clock here. About 100 million human beings enter the consuming class every year now in this world, most of them in Asia. And probably most of them are going to tread some way down the path that we have beaten out for them into a consumer world. So we better also be able to figure out how to make that possible without overwhelming the physical systems of the planet. And the good news is that simply switching everything we do to electricity reduces our total energy consumption considerably because stuff gets so much more efficient. So if you're driving an internal combustion engine car, 70% of the energy that you're burning is just being expressed as heat. Only about 30% is being used to push your car down the road. Now, if you're in an EV, those numbers flip, better than flip. So I think we can have a lot of the things that humans want without doing huge damage. The problem is that we've waited a long time to get here. There's a lot of damage already locked into the system, as I'm afraid that Hawaii, between the fires and the floods, has discovered over the last couple of years. I'll say just in passing that I was very impressed to read recently about this bill working its way through the legislature that will let insurance companies put the touch on big oil and their profits to pay for some of those damages. That strikes me as extremely wise. But all of this undergirds the need to do this as quickly as we can. We're going to run the world on sun and wind in 40 years, surely because of economics. But if it takes us anything like 40 years to get there, the world we run on sun and wind is going to be a broken one. Our job is to speed up this thing. Hawaii's already done some good stuff with solar. If we could make it work here where I live in the Green Mountains of Vermont, you guys are so lucky, man. Sun and wind galore. There's no reason that boat bringing that oil needs to keep coming anymore. It'd be awful nice to just turn it around the way the Pakistanis have started to.
Or let it come across and bring us some turbines and some panels.
Exactly right. And here's a way to think about that. Here's a number. If a boat arrives carrying a load of solar panels, over their lifetime, they'll produce 120 times as much energy as if the boat had arrived full of coal. The numbers are just astonishing here. The sun already gives us light. It gives us warmth via photosynthesis. It gives us our supper. Now it's willing to give us all the energy we could ever want and do it without polluting our cities, without changing the climate. If we wanted it, man, we've got a new world in sight.
That was Bill McKibben, author of Here Comes the Sun, and Scott Cooney, founder of Clean Technica, the company that hosts this weekend's Sustainability Expo and Electric Home Show at the Blaisdell Center. McKibben will be the keynote speaker on Sunday. For details, check out our show page. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to hear from the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce about how its members are dealing with the tariff refunds and bracing for rising fuel costs to their bottom line. Are you a small business navigating the uncertainty? Share your story, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.